So the subject is the mantra and meditation principles, practices and benefits. Now, most of you may be familiar with different types of mantras. In all organized religions, spiritual traditions, you find great saints and sages have practiced meditation, concentration, and very often in their spiritual practices, they made extensive use of certain sacred word symbols, which are called mantras. Word symbol. It's a very important point to remember. The word mantra is defined in spiritual tradition, Vedantic tradition, as Mananath Trayati Iti Mantra. This is the ancient Sanskrit definition. A sacred word symbol that helps you to attain the highest spiritual liberation, that saves you from worldly problems, agonies, and all the miseries associated with worldly life, and takes you across the ocean of worldliness. It's literal meaning. Now, word manana, I shall explain this a little, then we'll come to the discussion part. Manana means intense concentration. Now, what gives a word its potency and power? Every time, every minute, our mind is thinking of different worldly objects. When we think about, even think of any object, there is a corresponding word that comes to our mind. When we think of the mountain, the word mountain is inseparable with the mountain idea. The word ocean is inseparable with the ocean idea. So every object in the world has its corresponding word symbol. They go together, in fact. We can never think of anything without simultaneously forming in our mind a corresponding word symbol. Now, every time, as I said, our mind is focusing on different worldly objects. When we look, mind and eyes come together and we focus on the visual objects. So we come to know of something that is standing in front of us. When our mind and ears come together, they focus on the sound that is coming from the vehicle that's passing in the streets. So we come to know of the existence of a moving vehicle. Similarly, when my mind and my sense of touch come together, I feel the presence of this paper in my hands. Without my sense of touch, it is not possible. And without the participation of the mind, it is not possible. So mind and the five senses of perception should go together to focus on any visual or audio object. And all these objects have got a corresponding word symbol, which is called names. Somebody, when I put this idea earlier on a previous occasion, somebody asked the question, well, suppose we go to a zoo, we meet an animal which we don't know the name of. Maybe for the first time we are seeing the strange animal. We don't know its name. Next week, when our mind goes back to that experience, we think of the animal, but we don't know the meaning, the name of that animal. In that case, what happens? The fact when I saw an animal, the name of which I do not know, this becomes its name. And when somebody fills up the gap, well, you know, the name of the animal that you saw last week is X, then that long phrase is replaced by X, that's all. In other words, there is no memory, no thought without a corresponding word symbol. Now, what is mantra? What is the sacred word symbol? To be very direct, I can say this much. Mantras are sacred word symbols which are being used by great spiritual seekers, saints and sages for centuries. When they learn this mantra, they learn its meaning, and then they go on concentrating on the meaning, on the essence of that mantra. It is this concentration that gives that mantra a special potency. I should give an example. In the four Upanishads, there are four great statements, which are called four great statements, called Mahavakya. Just one example. In the Chandogya Upanishad, there is one Mahavakya, Tattvam Asi. It's a Mahavakya, great statement, which a sage, a saint, teaches his son. His son was sent for education, but it was a bit too late. The sage was wandering all over the country, teaching and learning in different hermit schools of ancient times. So when they returned home, when he returned home after several years, he found his son had already grown up, 12 years old. He should have initiated his son into his formal Vedic education when the son had already reached his 8th year, but it was very late, or 7th year. So the sage asked him, "See, you are too late. You should go to a school now." The boy goes to a school. The boy's name is Shvetaketu, and the son and the father's name is Uddalaka. If you want to read more, you can read the 6th chapter of Chandogya Upanishad. Well, he goes to his school, and after 12 years of education, he returns home. Then the sage puts one simple question to his son. "Did you learn that by learning which everything becomes known? Did you learn the essence of all learning, the supreme spiritual wisdom?" The boy had not even heard of that kind of education, which enables you to learn the supreme spiritual wisdom, which makes everything sensible and meaningful. He said as much. Then, of course, the father of the boy, is Uddalaka, teaches him the supreme spiritual truth, the supreme spiritual absolute reality is one divine principle that is present in all of us, which is immanent, omnipresent, and transcendental. And that reality is within your own heart. It is yourself, Tattvamasi. This is the mantra. Of course, this comes at the end of it. The 16th part, the 16th Brahmana, 16th section of the 6th chapter of Chandogya Upanishad. I'm coming to the mantra aspect of it. So the meaning of this mantra is the supreme reality, God Almighty, whom we are searching, is omnipresent. It is all-pervading, and it is present in all of us. You yourself is that supreme reality, not the body, not the mind, not the intellect, not the senses, but the inner divine principle, the supreme consciousness, the Atman. This divine principle is within us. God is not creating this world as sitting outside. God is sitting within all of us. This is a simple meaning. Now, for centuries, maybe for thousands of years, great saints and sages have been meditating on this mantra. Oh, there is another mantra in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. I am, in fact, not this body, not this mind, not intellect. I am the all-pervading supreme consciousness, Aham Brahmasmi. Like that, all these great statements are there. These great word symbols, which is called mantras, have been meditated upon, concentrated upon, by saints and sages for thousands of years. So they accumulate a special spiritual potency. When we become spiritual seekers, when our mind is pure, when we are ready, and when we focus on the meaning of the same sacred symbol, the accumulated spiritual potency of the mantra comes to our mind. This is how mantra and its power are transmitted from teacher to disciple. Well, in our own life we can see, we don't judge a word by its dictionary meaning. We don't do that. Suppose your grandmother scolds you. Maybe she may use a very, perhaps somewhat an uncomplimentary expression. You don't get angry with her. You don't go to the dictionary and find out the meaning is certainly not very desirable. So I should take action against her. You don't do that, at least not in civilized society. Because the word was used by your grandfather or grandmother who had affection for you, who was always thinking about your welfare. So out of love and affection, this word came from the grandmother. But suppose the same word is used by the hotel receptionist when you go to a hotel to check in, or by the sales executive in the Trader Joe's when you went there to buy something, and if they use the same word, I don't want to use examples of those words, it's not pretty proper, but then the meaning will be different, the effect on our mind will be different. Meaning is the same. Go to the dictionary, whether Webster or Oxford Dictionary, Chambers, meaning is the same. Dictionary meaning is the same. Then what made the difference? In one context, we feel grateful. Many people look back. When they look back, they often bow their heads in gratitude to the great teachers who may have scolded them in their kindergartens. And while scolding, they may have used certain word symbols, which may not have very complimentary meaning. So, the power of the word comes not from the dictionary, but from the speaker. So the speaker, the one who uses the word, renders a special power to the words that he or she uses. Similarly, the great word symbols and mantras you find in all religious traditions, so Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, the Sufi tradition especially. In all these traditions you find great prayers. Sometimes prayers also become, they take the form of word symbols. Great statements made by great sages who had this inner experience also assume the spiritual potency of mantras, word symbols. When we repeat the same words with the same spiritual earnestness, they have a different message, they have a different potency, they have a different impact on our mind. And when we repeat them, we become spiritually benefited. Otherwise, you just, of course, I need not give examples. If you tuned radio in a particular frequency or wavelength, suddenly you get BBC, you may get Voice of America. What does it mean? All these words are everywhere. Only you should tune the machine to the particular frequency of wavelength. Then you get these words. Similarly, if you sit in this room and close your eyes, I mean the sincere, pure mind, repeat word symbols, mantras, which have accumulated spiritual potency by hundreds of years of repetition by saints and sages, then these word symbols will have a corresponding impact in our mind. That's how mantras or word symbols become potent and powerful. This is what really happens in spiritual life. Now, why do we need to utter these mantras? I'm just giving a bird view of some of these ideas, then I will take up one subject after another, and we will discuss more elaborately during the interaction for 30 minutes. Now, why do we need these mantras? You can read a book and start repeating. Here, there is a very important point to remember, you know. As I said earlier, every minute our mind is distracted towards various worldly objects. Mind is full of thoughts, and every thought has its corresponding word symbols. When we try to meditate, sit calmly, not even meditate, you sit calmly somewhere. Then suddenly you find all kinds of conflicting thought currents suddenly come to the surface of the mind. We never could imagine that we could actually think of those thought currents. We can't even imagine. Maybe a psychologist will tell you, will try to trace the origin of these thought currents and may hypnotize you and may go all the way to your memory formation years where you had certain experiences which created a strong, registered a strong impression or tendency in your mind. All these will come to the surface when you try to sit somewhere quietly. Not necessarily to meditate, even to sit calm quietly. All these thought currents will come to the surface. But when we try to meditate, it is all the more so. Because mind is sometimes compared to a lake. A very dirty, filthy lake which has not been cleaned for 2, 3 decades. Think of such a lake or a pond. It'd be 100 feet deep. 90 feet of water is full of different layers of weeds, filth, dirt, mud, and so on. 10 feet of clean water, pure water. So you can't see the bottom. Now, if you want to clean up this lake, you take a long pole, you try to stir the lake. Then what happens? All kinds of mud, dirt, and filth and bacteria start coming to the surface. Meditation is like that. When you meditate, we are actually trying to clean up this lake. If the lake is clean, the lake can reflect the consciousness Atman. When it is full of 90 feet of dirt and filth, it cannot reflect anything. You can't see the bottom. So when we try to sit somewhere and when we try to start spiritual life, when you start thinking seriously about spiritual life, actually, what we are doing, we are trying to clean up the lake. Now, when these thought currents come to the surface, the normal method is we should not fight with them. We should calmly sit without participating. When these thought currents come, we should not be shocked. When good thought currents come, we should not be delighted. When undesirable thought currents come, we should not become depressed. The question is asked, what's the source of these thought currents? As I said earlier, a hypnotist may be able to explain some of the thought currents that are coming to the surface of the mind. Perhaps you may have met with an accident when in childhood days. So, if people suffer from psychiatric problems and phobia related to childhood experiences, the hypnotist will be able to give a healthy counseling by explaining the association between these phobias and the childhood experience. And that explanation can perhaps help the patient. But there are many memories, many ideas, many thought currents that come to the surface, which cannot be explained in the light of experiences of this life. That's a point. That's why in modern psychiatry, two problems are sometimes explained in the light of experiences not belonging to this life, but experiences belonging to past life. One is multiple personality, the other is schizophrenia, more or less interrelated. Why is it that our mind is full of conflicting thought currents? Very often we find we want to meditate, we are willing to take a strong decision, but then we cannot do. There's a great warfare, fighting going on between what we want to do and what we are able to do. What the mind is willing to participate and what the mind is not willing to participate. Many people are very sincere when they read a good book, when they listen to wonderful lectures. Sometimes they take a very strong, sincere decision where they will bring about a change in their life. But they are not able to do that. Some invisible power appears to prevent, create a stumbling block. So this conflict between mind and intellect, an intellect that recognizes the need for starting a new spiritual life, a new chapter in our life, on the one hand, and a mind which tries to prevent. So here we have to explain this in the light of previous life. In fact, this is an important point to understand human personality. And without understanding what we actually are, we will not be able to understand the meaning of mantra and to face some of the conflicts that we face in spiritual life, that we have to confront in spiritual life. So, what really happens is, whatever we have done in this life, we can remember, more or less, with name and form. Very clear remembrances. If something had happened to us in our childhood days, suppose we were chased by an elephant, we may even remember the name of the elephant and also the form of the elephant. So, it is a thought current accompanied by a name and form. But there are many abstract, inexplicable, indescribable thought currents, ideas, tendencies, impressions, which are very strong, which constitute almost 95% of what we are, our personality, our character, and how we live in this world, cannot be explained in the light of experiences in this life. So both Vedanta philosophy and yoga try to explain this. In the light of previous life experiences. Whatever we do, And it's an important point to remember. Whatever we do consciously, I'm doing this. I feel, well, I associate myself. I interpret myself as the doer of this action. And I interpret myself as the one who is going to enjoy the results of this action. Whatever conscious action we do will create an impact in our mind, a tendency, a subtle abstract tendency, and which is very powerful, which we cannot openly understand. It's not very obvious, but which belong to the lower layers of the mind lake, tendencies and impressions. Whatever we do consciously will create a tendency. A tendency is the residual factor, the subtle factor that is left over of actions. If the results of our actions are pleasant, we will have a tendency to repeat the action even if it is not necessary. If the results are unpleasant, we may have a tendency to avoid the action even if it is essential. In fact, when conflicting thought currents come to the surface of the mind, when we start spiritual life, what is happening is the unpleasant, the undesirable, the non-cooperating tendencies created by actions done in previous life are coming to the surface and trying to prevent. In fact, that's what happens even in normal day-to-day activities. Students who want to study hard, but then cannot do that. Office workers who want to work with great sincerity, but they find themselves, they are not able to do what they would like to do. This can be found not only in spiritual, in the context of spiritual practices, but even in the context of normal day-to-day activities. An ongoing warfare between the will and the mind. Will, I mean, in the intellect. We take a decision, we want to do something, we are very sincere. If it is a purely physical action, we will do. Because at the physical level, the opposition is much more easy to overcome. But at a subtle mental level, the opposition is very difficult to overcome. So, these invisible tendencies and impressions that we have accumulated in previous life sometimes can be helpful, sometimes may not be helpful. So they create so many points of focus when we sit, when we walk, when we live in this world. Mind is distracted to so many diverse focuses of concentration. This mind should be drawn inward from diversity of focuses of concentration. We should graduate to a single great focus. It's something like this, you know, water is everywhere. But if you want to drink water, you have to dig a well somewhere. And you have to go on digging the well on the same spot. Otherwise, you won't get water. Similarly, what happens? Mind is distracted to so many objects of concentration. So diverse focuses, focus points outside, at the external world. This mind should be turned inward. But we cannot deal with mind as we deal with external objects. With your hand, you can take a decision and we are going to do cooking and we can do cooking straight away. Nobody will stand in your way. But we cannot dictate your own mind. Driving, we can do it physically. We can face the opposition. I mean, well, I won't drive, but I will drive. You can follow your determination to drive and go ahead driving. But you cannot ask your own mind, you should think this way. If you ask the mind, you should think this way, the mind will certainly start thinking the opposite way. In fact, that's a special trick of the mind. I have told, to give an example, I mentioned this sometime earlier. Concentration can be from both ends. It is said that one young man who was slowly becoming bald-headed, losing his hair, went to a physician, and the physician wanted to make fun of him and told him, "See, you should never think of an open surface. So you should never think of an egg. If you think of an egg, your head will become like an egg." So the man from that day onwards, he was working so hard not to think of an egg, which means every moment he was thinking of an egg and he lost all his hair. Similarly, we cannot ask our mind to think this way and not to think the other way. Mind won't listen to us. So what we need, mind should be given a gradual, a natural, an effortless direction. So, if you repeat one sacred mantra, or if you loudly chant one hymn, mind will naturally be withdrawn from all the other points of focus in the external world, and mind will slowly take a turn inward. It may not be successful at the beginning. If you start thinking of one sacred mantra, you may be thinking of that. You may think you're thinking of that, but your mind should be elsewhere, maybe elsewhere. This is possible. But then gradually the mind gets withdrawn. It may take several years of practice. The mind slowly gets withdrawn from other external points of focus, other external points of concentration, and then slowly turn inward. Now, suppose you repeat one sacred mantra, a word symbol, with great concentration, with great earnestness. Of course, earnestness or strong desire is a very important necessity for success in meditation and also in the repetition of mantra. Because a strong desire, a strong earnestness drives away all the diverse tendencies, distracting tendencies, and gives an intensity to the practice. So what happens? When we try to repeat one sacred mantra, that mantra reduces external distractions by creating a counter focus within ourselves. You are not thinking of an invisible external object, but you're trying to think of a higher spiritual ideal, which is represented by the sacred mantra or word symbol. So, the highest spiritual seeker, after several years of practice, can think of God even in a marketplace. Because even while sitting in a marketplace, with all the activities going on around him or her, he can think of the sacred word symbol, if you have practiced with great sincerity and for long years. That means he has succeeded in creating a single counter focus, which neutralizes all the external distractions by providing a counter focus on which he can concentrate. That's why you find great spiritual seekers can think of God even in a marketplace, in a factory, or in the workplace, or in an office. But at the beginning, even in a temple or a church or synagogue or any place of worship, it may not be always easy for a beginner. For some time, we succeed in thinking of the higher spiritual ideas in a sacred place. But then, slowly, what happens? Mind gets distracted. And how does a sacred place become sacred? How does a temple or a Buddhist temple, a Buddhist place of worship or a synagogue or a church, how do these places become sacred? What's the difference between a marketplace and a sacred place of worship? The difference is this much. That also is related to mantra. In a sacred place, there is a strong vibration which is invisible. Abstract thought currents which are invisible, created by great spiritual seekers, saints and sages, who have come to that place, who have thought of great spiritual ideas, who have prayed, have contemplated. When they contemplate, these thought currents fill the air. And when you go there, even though you may not be an advanced spiritual seeker, the prevailing thought currents will lift your mind to a higher spiritual level. That's why we feel much more easy to pray, to meditate in a sacred place. I remember an incident which really happened in the history of San Francisco monastery. A great Christian devotee, but he was a Christian devotee may not be great because he was a bit of a fundamentalist who believed that Christianity is the only religion in the world, unlike many other enlightened people. So what happened? He came to our old temple. But he was a great devotee in his own way. He used to pray, he used to read the Bible. So in that way, he was very sincere. But when he lived for a few days in the old temple in San Francisco, he felt very happy. And when he was leaving the place, he thought, well, I feel like praying to God when I lived here. He said, I always felt like praying to God, thinking of God during the 3-4 days that I spent here. Now that person had not read anything about any tradition other than his own denomination of Christianity, mind you. Now he was not a Catholic, he was not a, so he believed only his own independent denomination. But he was a very sincere seeker. So he lived in that old temple. While departing the place, he made a statement to a very senior monk of our order. Well, I felt like praying to God when I stayed here. Now, what really happened? That place was associated with great spiritual seekers. For decades, almost for more than 100 years, great spiritual seekers have been coming. So anybody belonging to any faith, if the person is a sincere seeker of spiritual truth, if you go to any sacred place, you feel your mind is lifted. Because spiritual ideas are universal. So, it is the accumulated spiritual tendencies, associations created by spiritual thought currents that make a place great and sacred. Anywhere in the world, any religious tradition, in any spiritual tradition, if you are a sincere spiritual seeker, devotee of God, or if you are a really good-natured, noble person, you feel an elevation of your mind. That's because of the power of sacred thoughts. And sacred thoughts are created by people who contemplated on the meaning of sacred word symbols. That is the psychology of mantra. So mantras are universal in a way. Mantras are universal in all religious traditions. In every religious tradition, these word symbols are used for spiritual concentration. So you have to remember, The first important purpose is to create a counter focus for the mind. The mind which is running right, which is running in search of worldly objects, sense objects, get a diversion, inward diversion. And mind slowly start thinking around and on the meaning of the sacred symbol. It is not enough to understand the word as such. It is also important to understand the meaning of the word, because it is meaning of the word that enables you to think deeply. So the manana means intense concentration, concentrated thinking. When we think of the meaning of a word with intense concentration, we identify ourselves with that word. That's why I shall explain in brief four levels of the spiritual aspect of mantra recitation, and then we will have interaction, and we will continue the lecture this evening. As I said, mantra is to be understood as a sacred word symbol which creates a counter focus, which helps the mind to turn inward so that we can think of a high spiritual ideal with concentration. There are four levels for mantra. In a way, in a broader sense, it is true of every word, every spoken or written word. The grossest and highest, and then two levels in between. What is the grossest, the most audible part of a word? What we hear, the sound vibrations, which we can hear, which is audible, is the grossest. It is, in Sanskrit, is called vaikari. Vaikari means what you can hear. If you, for a beginner, you may have to shout, because mind is shouting in so many ways, so many voices mind is creating. So what happens? You may chant a mantra very loudly, or you may recite a hymn very loudly. Sometimes I know there are many denominations who violently repeat some psalms, some hymns. It is good. In a way, it is one way of diverting our mind towards God. Not the best way, of course, not the highest way, but it is one of the many ways. Because mind is running right, mind is shouting otherwise. We can't hear it, but it's shouting, creating noise. So what happens? We also shout loudly, audibly. So what happens? But we are shouting a sacred symbol, maybe a hymn, a psalms, some prayers. You shout. Immediately mind is, in a gross way, turn towards the audible dimension of the spoken word, which is the grossest. The audible dimension of the spoken word is the grossest. That's why sometimes you find this found in all religious traditions. Loud chanting, loud recitation, sometimes using different musical instruments, because that's how they try to create a counter focus. A Ramana Maharshi or a Jesus or a Buddha will not need to shout loudly, because the mind is already focused. But a person who is going to spiritual kindergarten, the beginning of spiritual life, we may need to practice prayers in a very gross, audible way. He said, kindergarten boy or a girl, we have to write very loud, very big letters. You know, then only child will be able to learn. Like that, spiritual beginner, a person who is just entered spiritual kindergarten, will have to shout, recite prayers, hymns, and so on. This is the grossest. Now, what is the highest level? The highest level is when you become associated, when you become one with the essence of that word, that is highest. So, the para or the supreme is one. When you become completely identified, when you establish, when you reach a kind of internal unity with the essence of the mantra, it is the supreme, it is the goal of all human life. Then you don't have to repeat. Your mind is already naturally and completely tuned to the spiritual vibration. You don't have to shout. You don't have to recite loudly. There are two levels in between. So, again, I will come to the lowest level. Perhaps it is not low, it is the beginning level, let us say. The grossest level. So, Vaikari, the audible level. Now, the next level is Madhyama. Madhyama means, from the audible level, you slowly start thinking of the meaning, the implication, the essence of the mantra, of the sacred word symbol. Then your voice comes down. Very often, you know, when you go deeper, our voice comes down. That's true in all branches of learning, in spiritual life. When we go deeper, when we understand the true meaning, the voice slowly comes down. Still, we may repeat, but still, it may come down. Because we are focusing on the meaning, on the implication of the word symbol. The third level is when we become identified, when we get a glimpse of the essence, the true essence of that word symbol. We reach the experience level of the word symbol. Till now, we were repeating sacred symbols, mantras, prayers. Now, we already reached an experience level of that spiritual level, spiritual practice. At the highest level, we become one with it. These are the four levels of practice of mantras. Of course, there is a still more simple way of explaining this. I shall take up the subject again in the evening session. Now we will have interaction for, let's say, 30 minutes.
When we are ready, the power of the mantra comes to us.
Yes.
How do we ready ourselves?
In fact, once we start spiritual practice, our mind develops the faculty. You know, the mind itself slowly can guide us. In fact, we are going to, we will go through the subject in the evening session. There is one great obstacle in spiritual life, and that is very important to remember. We should never try to logically analyze and create a roadmap in spiritual life. See, we will understand the third step only when we reach the second step. That's the main difference between spiritual life and all other aspects of life. So, one of the great obstacles that Patanjali refers to in spiritual life is our tendency to get a complete roadmap and to clear all doubts before we start the enterprise, spiritual enterprise. This tendency that I must get all my path clear before I start, it is that tendency itself is an obstacle. So Patanjali, what Patanjali says is, take the first step and you are sure you will reach the next step. That's a very interesting subject. If you want, I can read that portion where, because this is very important in spiritual life. So I shall just try to read that portion. Potentially, in this Samadhipada, gives one interesting discussion. Vyadhi sthyana samsya pramada alasya virati brandi darsana alabdha bhumigattu anavasthitattvani chitta vikshepasthe antarayaha. Antaraya means obstacles. Normally, you know, sometimes doubts become a great problem. And in fact, doubt is one of the prominent obstacles that Patanjali, the great yoga philosopher, yoga psychologist, refers. What happens is, we think we can solve a problem in spiritual life through direct perception and inference, through normal tools of epistemology, I may say. When we, in physics and philosophy, use these tools, epistemological tools, theory of knowledge, direct perception, inference, comparison, presumption, and then verbal testimony, and, you know, all these are different tools we use in philosophy, logical tools, epistemological tools. In spiritual life, these tools are absolutely of no use. Because in spiritual life, we are dealing with our own mind. What our mind is going to do, how it is going to function tomorrow, we can never be sure. That's the main problem with the mind. We can be sure how the machine is going to work, because machine has got borrowed intelligence, programmed intelligence. It is predetermined. But mind is not predetermined. So in spiritual life, one speciality of spiritual life is when we take the first step and start moving forward, the second step automatically and naturally becomes obvious to us. And a mind which has reached the first step, which has reached the second step, has the faculty of guiding us towards the third step. So that's a very important point to remember. So there is no external symbol, external signboard that we can make use of. Of course, if you get training under a master, a teacher, every day, as they used to have in ancient times, it may be easy, but maybe for the modern times, great teachers like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and Vivekananda and others, many great teachers, they say, if you sincerely follow this fundamental basic disciplines, then our mind develops a kind of GPS system, you know, global positioning system, which can guide us in the proper direction. Sri Ramakrishna used the word, mind becomes our own guru. A sincere mind, which is sincerely practicing, takes us straight to our goal. Logically, we can never be sure, never analyze spiritual life. Because logic is related to empirical knowledge. But spiritual life is trans-empirical. That's the main difference. Yes.
Swami, you mentioned about the meaning of mantra. But there are some seed mantras, for example, for Shat Chakras. Just have sounds.
Yes.
No words.
Yes.
I will explain.
Well, I will go deeper into the subject since you raised the question. Mantras are generally divided into two categories. One, Bija mantras. The other one is Omkara. Omkara is sometimes used along with Bija mantra, sometimes not. Om is universal symbol. Bija mantras related to different deities, different deities of the pantheon, spiritual pantheon, will take you to the realization of that particular deity. So Shakta, Vaishnava, and this Shakta is one, Vaishnava. These are the two prominent. Other systems are the Kaumara, Saura, Ganapati, all that. But these are two prominent. Shakta and Vaishnava traditions have got innumerable Bija mantras. So they often use different bijas like cream, om, etc. In combination with that the name of the particular deity. That's how they repeat it. The repetition of this mantra will take you to the realization of the supreme reality in the form of that deity. All these deities, all these gods and goddesses are different aspects of the one supreme reality. But if you repeat Bija mantras for independent deities of the pantheon, that practice will take you to the realization of that particular deity. That's why Omkara is the sacred symbol for, is a universal symbol for realization of Brahman in mostly in the non-dualistic Advaita tradition. But in non-Advaitic tradition, these Bija mantras are used for repetition that help you to towards the realization of the particular deity, realization of the same Brahman, the universal absolute reality, in the form of the particular deity.
Another thing is, mantras seem to be, originated more or less in India only. What about the rest of the mystics in the world?
Mantras are a very important part of practice in Russian Orthodox Church. It's a very important practice, Russian Orthodox Church.
No, but about the Western
mystics. Yes, that's true.
They realize too, but without mantra or that such.
But, in the tradition of the medieval Catholic mystics, there was the constant practice of certain hymns and symbols and prayers. Mantras need not necessarily mean one symbol or word or phrase or anything. Mantra actually means anything that saves you and that helps you to reach the highest spiritual truth by repetition. Repetition, not necessarily the word. A psalm can be a mantra. Even in a non-verbal icon, pratika we call, can be a mantra. So mantras need not necessarily mean mantra as it is understood in Hindu religious tradition or Vedantic tradition. Mantras literally means mananatrayati iti mantraha. I shall read out and explain with greater clarity. Then I'll come to your question. Please remember. Manana tranana chaiva madrubasya avabodhanat mantram ityuchyate brahman madadishthanato piva. So this is a definition of what mantra is in Yoga Shirovanishad. So you repeat, then you concentrate on the meaning of the mantras that you repeat, and that helps you towards the realization of the supreme all-pervading reality in the form of the particular deity whose Bija mantra you are repeating. Because that Bija mantra becomes the seat of the particular deity. So this could mean a hymn, a psalm, or anything. So there, in the Sufi tradition, mantra is commonly used. And most religious traditions, mantras are used. So when we use the Sanskrit word mantra, we should not define it in the Vedantic tradition alone. It has got a universal spiritual dimension. That should be understood. No, I'll come to that. Now, please, once more, what's the question? We'll continue the discussion.
Yeah, that's a very, very important, because I was raised with a Jewish mantra, which Hebrew repetition is similar to Sanskrit repetition. So it seems very universal.
Yes, what I want to stress is mantra should be understood in the universal dimension. In fact, many saints and sages belonging to non-Vedantic tradition, I mean in the non-Upanishadic tradition, used to repeat hymns, parables, word phrases taken from different parables, and contemplate on that. So anything that becomes a focus for intense concentration and meditation and contemplation becomes an instrument for you to reach the highest. So that's a universal dimension of the meaning of the word mantra. In that respect, in that aspect, you find mantras are found in all traditions. Even in the non-organized religious traditions, the Aztecs and the many African spiritual traditions, in the so-called pagan, I won't use that term, pre-Christian European religious traditions, in the Greek mystery religious traditions, they had these different types of mantras which they used to repeat. So they also can be called mantras in that sense. That's the point.
Yeah, I had another question, the practice of mantra presuppose this mind. How can that lead to the annihilation of mind?
Yes. As I said, mind, right now your mind is the mind of a beginner in spiritual life is distracted towards diverse objects in the sensory world. Thought currents and conflicting thought currents are coming to the mind, surfacing the mind. Now, the first goal is to get the mind withdrawn from this diversity of points of focus and create a single powerful counter-focus. And the repetition of these mantras enables you to form in your mind a counter-focus which reduces distraction. And then the mind even goes beyond that focus.
Yeah.
But that's a highest level. That's why when you reach the para level of mantra, para means the highest, you become one with what you meditate upon, what the essence of what you recite, what you repeat. That's the highest level. At the beginning of the Vaikari level, when you're loudly shouting, it helps you to get the mind withdrawn from so many diverse points of focus in the external world. At the highest level, you become one with that essence of it. That's a paraj called. So, next question.
Yeah, my question is about deafness. At the grossest level of experiencing sound, the grossest physical level, if we experience too much sound in a noisy world, let's say rock and roll music on a high decibel level, we lose our hearing and we become deaf. It's very slow to come back if it comes back at all. And
that's why there are many of these the same type of music. They use some Vedic mantras. Ekam sati prabhugudha vadandi. I heard a rap group, I don't know what group it is. They were very violent, that I can be sure, and very, very loud. In Chicago, I saw a performance with huge drums and cymbals, all kinds of musical instruments, orchestra they were using, but they were repeating the Vedic mantra, Ekam Sat Vipra Bhagudha Varandi. The truth is one, the sages call it by different names. So sometimes, they make use of even prayers, sacred word symbols for this kind of music.
It's very popular. I've seen Bijan groups with amplified music that's deafening. Don't want to elaborate on that because I have a different question. Debating on whether that's a good use or an abuse of the sacred art is a different discussion. My question is about spiritual deafness. And I have a personal concern about this. I live in a very noisy world, and it affects my spiritual focus. And I'm hoping that I can understand a path out of deafness. But because on a physical level, it's clear that one can become deaf. My question is, does that apply to the spiritual practice as well, or is there a way out?
Well, too many sounds in a very physical level may not be helpful in developing an intense inner spiritual focus. But again, it depends upon the level of spiritual seekers. See, those who make use of these popular methods, musical programs, and if those who make use of the sacred word symbols for this music, they are, in a way, they are giving a spiritual dimension to that type of music. It's really very noisy and destructive. But then, not for all. Those who are serious, those who are a little more evolved, they can make use of repetition and slowly evolving from gross to subtle. I shall explain this, in another aspect. There are three levels of evolution in repetition of mantra. One is called, vachikam. This means purely word. You use word. Spoken word. Again, is gross. As written, spoken word, gross. Then, so you repeat, people repeat these sacred symbols, hymns or psalms or phrases or mantras loudly. Physical repeat, recitation, vachikam it is called, verbal, that's all. When people become more introspective, when they become more serious about internal spiritual experience, they do repetition but without making noise. Because when you can repeat without producing an audible noise, speech system, audible system, it goes deeper. When we hear what we speak, it doesn't go deeper. When we repeat without it becoming audible, our mind goes deeper, we become more contemplative. At the highest level, you repeat at a mental level. Mentally repeat. Your lips won't move. At the second level, lips may move, but you won't hear it. Others won't hear it. The third level, even your lips won't move. Mentally, you're always repeating the mantra. So, depending upon our own level of spiritual fitness, we can choose whatever we want. Those who are very serious, those who are not interested in the audible, the physical dimension of it, can certainly repeat. Maybe the lips may move, and at the highest level, even their lips may not move, but mentally you will be repeating that. That is the practice of some of the great mystics in Philokalia and Brother Lawrence, all you find some of them. That's why their mind goes back and they take stock of their own spiritual growth and writes like that, you find. They sometimes interpret their own progress and repeat again in the writings of St. Teresa of Avila, you come across. Looking back, interpreting the past events, obstacles, and so on. So, at the highest level, mentally we do everything. At the highest level.
Beethoven just came to mind. Beethoven. Did you tell that story about Beethoven?
Transcending the difference. Yes, the Ninth Symphony. I will come to you, please.
Swami, I was thinking about the great Advaita teacher Nisargadatta Maharaj, taught in this little apartment on a terribly busy street in Bombay, up on the third floor, and there were trucks and buses and people yelling and screaming outside, and he taught every day in this little apartment and people would go and they would be completely aware of the supreme reality there.
Yes.
And commented on his ability to not be distracted by all of these sounds.
Yes. Well, you know, this distracting world, the physical world, noisy world, can be used as a tool for turning away from it. Sometimes, you know, in fact, the madness, the sheer madness of this physical world with all its noises and distractions and problems itself can be used as a point of concentration. Then our mind go higher level. In the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, there is a very interesting incident, you know. One wandering mystic came to Dakshineswar temple where he was living. He had in his hand a small mango plant and practically looked as a very bizarre, you know, weird and uncool type of person. He was apparently not clean or anything, was not talking. But anyway, but Sri Ramakrishna looked at him and found this man is really a great spiritual seeker. He is a realized person. And you know, when looking at the Ganga, at the waves, mighty waves of the river, the rainbow and the clouds and the sky, the trees and flowers and plants, and the temple compound, all this, oh, what a wonderful creation of the Lord. So even the physical, phenomenal world can direct you towards God. The sublimity, the beauty, the grandeur, instead of the noisiness, the distractions, and the chaos, we can interpret the world as a manifestation of God's glory, His harmony, His sense of harmony, its sublimity, its beauty and grandeur. So, different spiritual seekers have different approaches in interpreting this world. But a beginner in spiritual life should slowly try to turn his mind away from sensory objects and then create a counter focus, realize the truth, and then come back to the world and look at the world from a different angle. The world from which he tried to turn his mind away now becomes a symbol of God's glory and greatness, sublime, sublimity. Please.
Yes, Swami, sometimes in mental repetition I find that the distinct words of the mantra get blurry and they're not being repeated specifically. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, yes. Well, depending upon the mantra, of course, we won't discuss it openly, but still, with gentle view, if you can read some book or read some prayers or anything related to that particular spiritual personality whom you are meditating upon before the mantra, then becomes more clear. So mind should be made ready, because otherwise, if you repeat before the mind is ready, it may create problems. So just before we start spiritual practices, we should make our mind ready either by reading, by reciting prayers, or at least listening to spiritual talks or spiritual songs, spiritual music. Then my mind should be slowly taken away from the chaotic world, and then if you start repeating, then mind will be more harmonious and cooperative. So mind should be slowly taken from the distractions of the world and gradually lifted to a higher level. That's the idea. And there is a great warning given to maybe most probably given by Swami Brahmanandaji, you find eternal companion. It's a famous example given. Brahmanandaji says, see, if a person wants to go to the top floor, the terrace of the building, and he's right now he's standing on the the courtyard, instead of taking the staircase, suppose somebody lifts him and drops him on the terrace, he may be hurt. Like that, from the distracting, from the distractions of the world, we should not suddenly try to lift our mind to a higher level by repeating mantra all of a sudden. Slowly we must take that staircase. So what's the staircase in this context? Reading a book on spiritual themes, listening at least tape recorded songs can be made use of, listening to spiritual music. And slowly when the mind is ready, we can start repeating. Otherwise, mind may create conflicts. That's a great...
What about physical things to do to calm the body? We are living in a very hectic environment. What does one do to calm physically? Are any of the other yogas helpful?
Hatha yoga.
Yes. Do you recommend that to steady the body, to calm the body?
Hatha yoga can be helpful only to give us a strong, healthy body so that we can sit quiet for a long time without disturbance. Spiritual realization doesn't have a direct relationship with physical yoga. But physical yoga can be very helpful, because if you want to sit straight and for a long time without distraction, a healthy body and poise may be helpful. For that, physical yoga comes handy. But physical yoga directly doesn't take us to the highest spiritual realization. It can be helpful, no doubt. That's the idea.
When we speak of speaking the mantra out loud, there's a vibration to that. And that vibration, to me, I call that physical, because it physically vibrates energetically in our body. So it would seem to me to be at some stage or during a hectic day that very, even if you've gone where you're not doing it audibly, that if there's a lot of noise and activity, that vibration might be very stabilizing to make that a part of practice.
Yes, repetition of any mantra or breathing exercises like physical yoga, all these generate energy and heat in the body. So suddenly we feel the overflow of energy. This can be a serious problem. In fact, it can lead to restlessness. So that's why before we start repeating the mantras, we must slowly get our mind ready. And how to get our mind ready? Mind should be slowly turned away from the distractions. Suppose we work very hard till 12 hours, then come and sit and meditate and repeat the mantra. It can be harmful. Slowly, to begin with, we may read some sacred book, holy scriptures, listen to spiritual songs, devotional music, or listen to a good lecture on devotional topics. Slowly take the mind to a little higher level and then repeat. Otherwise, if we sit quiet and then start repeating, all of a sudden from a distracted, busy day, at the end of the day, it can lead to restlessness. It can lead to conflicts. Because it, as I said, Brahmanandaji's instruction is very, very relevant in this context. Sitting quiet in solitude in our room to recite the mantra or to meditate is like aspiring to go to the terrace of the building. So we must take the staircase. It means we must first take the mind to a little higher level. staircase, you know, one step, second, third step, slowly we evolve. So we can listen to spiritual devotional music, read holy scriptures, and slowly lift the mind to a higher level, and then start repeating the mantras. Any kind of sudden effort can create jerks, and that could be harmful. In fact, many of these problems manifest in the form of conflicts, restlessness, exuberance of energy, and that will be automatically followed by minor depression. Sudden loss of energy, sudden exuberance of energy, it's all this. So that's why slowly we must evolve. Take step 1, 2, 3 like that. That's the idea behind it. I think, so we have just, so we will continue the discussion in the evening at 3:30 to 5, we'll continue the same discussion. Now, after refreshments, that is from 11:30 to 12 o'clock refreshments, we will have meditation from 12 to 1 p.m., then 1 to 3:30 free time, 3:30 to 5 o'clock, again, mantra, meditation, principles and practice, so the same subject discussion. So thank you.